From APR, American Public Radio.
Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston C.A. It's interesting to note that in our time, ideas of civic virtue almost inevitably call forth images of the thoroughly independent individual. A person who, in the moral, political, and intellectual realms of action, tends to stand apart. But it was not always thus. The idea of what civic virtue is has changed a great deal over time, and understanding that evolution will help us better understand the way our institutions and our democracy have themselves evolved. My guest today is Paul Ray, professor of history at the University of Tulsa. Paul Ray, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you very much.
Paul, I love topics like this because they, I think, inform us just how important history is to the way we act today. And I'd like to begin our conversation by going back, in a sense, to things as they were in ancient times, classical notions of what virtue was, what I might characterize as the essential qualities of civic virtue as it was understood by the Greeks and the Romans. And from my scant understanding, it seems to me to have had a great deal to do with the preservation of the state. But I'd love to get your sense of what virtue was in the classical sense and sort of its ancient meaning.
In a certain sense, probably the best way of putting it is virtue is a kind of solidarity, kind of communal solidarity. As a consequence of that, ancient reflection of an extended sort on virtue, the kind of thing you find obliquely in Homer and explicitly in Plato, Aristotle, and Cicero, always focuses on friendship as the central feature of the virtuous man, as the sphere within which virtue reveals itself. By the same token, the political community is understood as a circle of friends. Hmm. Now, they understand that's problematic, too, but in some sense, that's the model. It's either a circle of friends or it's an alliance of families. And political freedom is understood in exactly those terms.
Yeah.
Another way of putting it is we are led by modern thought to reflect upon ourselves as individuals, standing alone, making our own moral decisions, incurring obligations by way of consent. In pre-modern societies, and I think universally, but certainly in ancient Greece and Rome, your understanding of who you are would be tied up with where you are and what relations you have with other people that have very little to do with your consent, which is to say family takes priority.
You're born into it.
You're born into it. You're born into a family. You're born into a city. You're born into a clan. And that is in some sense definitive.
Mm-hmm.
And other relationships are assimilated to that model.
Right.
So that the city is understood as a large family or mm-hmm. as a family writ large.
I want to probe this a bit further, Paul, because this is fascinating. I'm taking it from what you say that, because I am interested in the origins of this. I mean, even in this ancient sense, where did they get it from? How did it evolve with them? And I'm getting a sense that is this a tribal notion, something that one would associate with sort of ancient agrarian societies, I would suppose, primarily? I mean, I'm trying to get a sense of how they got the idea that this is what friendship was and how the community would base its...
It's no longer popular to talk about human nature, but it seems to me that this understanding of obligation and of morality is a natural understanding.
Yeah.
And the sign that it's a natural understanding is that in our own day, even though we live in polities dominated by intellectual constructs that are hostile to this notion, it lives on. There was a time not so long ago in which Mayor Daley, that is to say, the Mayor Daley of sainted memory, the elder Mayor Daley, the father of the current mayor of Chicago, and thereby hangs another tale, was accused of having found a job for his son in some aspect of city works. I don't know which son. And he responded to this accusation on television in Chicago, and he says, if you can't do something for your own family, what can you do?
Right.
Now, this was politically effective.
Yeah.
Now, this particular claim, even though it ran against the whole grain of American politics.
Because where was the resonance of it? This is interesting. I mean, why was it politically effective?
I think it was politically effective because it appealed to something we all know, which is that we have obligations to take care of those who are our own.
Yeah. Let's look at what we might, to use a term in vogue these days, consider the downside of this. I mean, even in this ancient expression. And here's the thought, Paul, that I had in mind as you described so eloquently this ancient, this classical notion of virtue. I'll pose it as a question. Did it allow for dissidence? I mean, could one, with this emphasis on family and on homonia, I guess is the word, or solidarity.
Homonoia.
Homonoia.
It means being of the same mind.
Being of the same mind. Well, that, good. That's I appreciate
that. So there
that.
Isn't much room
well,
for
exactly.
dissonance.
Well, exactly. Well, maybe that's the answer. Well, you explain it.
Dissonance requires a kind of separating of oneself from whatever community one is a dissident within. And the supreme ancient example is obviously Socrates. Right. And Socrates is, in some sense, a man alone. He represents himself in the Apology. He speaks to the jury, and he calls them, you Athenians. He doesn't call them you jurymen or you justices, which is roughly what the Greek would say. He calls them Athenians as if he's not an Athenian. And insofar as he insists upon independence of mind, which is really the thrust of his argument, he's separating himself from the city. He's differentiating himself from the city. And he claims to have, rhetorically at least, he claims to have a kind of divine mission that makes him, in a certain sense, a non-Athenian within the city. He's, in some sense, a stranger within the community.
And a threat to it.
Yes, and a threat to it. We, in modern times, are all, in some sense, strangers in our own country. We construct the community out of a kind of individualism. It's not quite the same as Socratic individualism, but it bears a certain kind of relationship to it. Socratic individualism is a kind of individualism of soul. The emphasis is on thinking and thought and individuation of that sort. The kind of individualism that we react to is an individualism of body. The focus is the fear of death, mm-hmm. and the knowledge that the separateness of bodies is the thing that you want to build upon. Now, this individualism of bodies can give rise to or protect an individualism of mind.
But it is essentially an individualism of bodies in the first
instance. Right. At its ultimate foundation.
Right.
That's right.
Paul, we're going to chart the evolution of the change in the notion of virtue, the idea of virtue over time. Let me stay for one moment longer on this question of the possible costs of it. I mean, we've been looking at its disallowance of dissidence, in a sense. I have in mind something that I attribute to Edward Gibbon and the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire when he was sort of laying out the reasons for the ultimate breakup of the empire. And as I was thinking about your topic and your research, one thought of his came to mind. One of the things that he felt was problematic in the Roman Empire was immobility, as he called it, which was kind of a not allowing discord or difference. So in a curious sense, I'm beginning to wonder if this kind of virtue, this ancient conception of virtue, ultimately worked against the preservation of the state, I mean, just by becoming so static over time and not allowing any kind of change or introduction of ideas.
This is certainly the criticism that is leveled from the time of Machiavelli on against ancient politics. That in some sense the quest for solidarity, and it's a solidarity of a moral character, binding people together through worshiping the same gods, for example. And it survives into the medieval period when the political community becomes a Christian commonwealth. The ancient Greek city, the ancient Roman city, was in some sense a church. The ancient Greek word for the assembly that people would meet in to make public decisions is ekklesia. That's the Latin word for church, and it's ultimately derivative from it. There is a sense in which the ancient Greek assembly, the assembly of the devout members of this particular political community worshiping its gods and so forth survives within the Christian church and survives, of course, within the Muslim mosque, which is in some sense the political community meeting. The movement in the early modern period to separate church and state, to make them independent of one another, to establish religious freedom so that your citizenship within the political community had nothing to do with your membership of a particular church, is a rebellion against that continuity between antiquity and the medieval period.
Is it too much to say, Paul, that in antiquity, church and state were co-identical?
No. It's the same. And one sign of that is that in ancient Greece, impiety and treason are the same thing.
Right. I guess the question at this point, Paul, against that magnificent background, is when do things change? Who changes them and why?
As far as I can tell, and my research is far from complete at this stage, I'm just beginning to write on this, and it will take some years to sort it out. The crucial figure is Machiavelli. And the heart of his analysis comes to something like this. If you go back to Aristotle, he talks about three types of friendship. Most friendships are a mixture of the three, but he separates them in analytical terms for the sake of clarity. There's a friendship of pleasure. That's the kind of friendship that unites children with one another. They really do love one another and cherish one another, but they do that because they play together and they have a good time together and they're bound together by that. Then there's a friendship of utility. It's the kind of friendship that would bind businessmen to one another. They may well be fond of one another. They may well care about one another. But the principal basis of the relationship is that they're useful to one another in one fashion or another.
The friendship of the deal, in a sense.
That's right. Mm-hmm. It's the friendship of the deal. Mm-hmm. The third kind of friendship, which is the one that for Machiavelli is problematic, is what Aristotle calls the friendship of virtue. The friendship of virtue would be the kind of friendship that might bind a husband and wife together. And it's because they have a common project for which they're both going to make sacrifices. The primary thing that binds them together, at least in theory, is not self-interest. It's the common project, which is usually children. It's the sort of thing that would bind two comrades together in a common struggle, both of whom are making sacrifices for this common struggle, both of whom may be willing to die for the common end. The model for this might be two soldiers in war, mm-hmm. Achilles and Patroclus, or something along those lines. Here, what ties them together is something larger than themselves that they're willing to make sacrifices for.
The friendship of the ideal, perhaps.
That's right. Yeah. Now, from Machiavelli's perspective, and from the perspective of Sir Francis Bacon, who examines this in detail in his essays, mm-hmm. this third kind of friendship, the friendship of virtue, is a fraud and a con. All friendship is once it's examined, Machiavelli has a wonderful phrase, the effectual truth of the matter. The effectual truth of the matter is that all friendship is friendship of utility or friendship of pleasure.
This is the acceptable notions of friendship, utility or pleasure.
That's right.
But the ideal is a con.
The ideal is a con. So when people band together, for example, in what we would call a political party, what Machiavelli sees that as is a conspiracy against the public good.
Paul, this is great. But the obvious question, I like the way you bring this down to brass tacks. Why? I mean, why is the friendship the ideal a con? I mean, what is it that's so objectionable about it? It sounds lyrical.
It's a con because all relations between human beings, from Machiavelli's perspectives, are relations of power. In that sense, you can see that Machiavelli is, in a certain sense, the ancestor of contemporary feminism in its more radical expressions, which interpret family relations as relations of power. Relations between men and women within a family turn out to be relations of exploitation and abuse.
You could extend that, couldn't you? I mean, it seems to me many modern political movements in our society are essentially based on notions of power, who controls power.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the Machiavellian notion is predominant within the modern analytical framework.
Yeah.
The consequence is that we all tend to think in these terms. Now, there's something else obviously at tension with this. we might want to analyze other people's relationships in terms of power. But if you or I fall in love, if we get married and we have kids, we wouldn't like to analyze our own relationships in those terms. It would be very, very disturbing to us. Is that because we are conning ourselves? Or is it because the Machiavellian analysis is misleading and one-sided? Let me read you a sort of crucial passage in Machiavelli. He distinguishes between salutary and unhealthy political conflict. He's the first political philosopher to suggest that homonoia, solidarity, isn't a good thing, that it is damaging to a political community, that it becomes stale and stagnant and in some sense turns on itself and is self-destructive. He suggests that unhealthy political conflict is tied up with the acquisition of what he calls reputation by private modes. And then he describes these private modes. And anyone who studied Roman history knows that this is exactly what goes on in a rather grand scale in Rome. Publicly, he says, reputation is acquired by conquering in battle, acquiring a district, conducting a legation with care and with prudence, counseling the republic wisely and to good effect. Through private modes, he says, it is acquired by doing favors for this or that other citizen, we call that patronage, by defending him from the magistrates, by aiding him with money, securing for him undeserved honors, and by gratifying the public, the plebs, he says, which is the Roman word, and that's a sign that he's talking about Rome, with public games and gifts. From this latter mode of proceeding, from the acquisition by private modes, are born sects and partisans, and the reputation thus earned wreaks harm to the public good, as much as reputation helps when it is not mixed up with sex, because the reputation is founded on a public good, not on a private good. So his view is that the politics of friendship, the politics predominant in Greece and Rome, the politics predominant in much of the world today, is damaging to the public good because it gives rise to faction.
And I can certainly see resonance of all of that in the way we conduct things today in our own society.
Oh, sure.
That's riveting.
Let me give you a sense of the sign of this. Any polity in which political party seems to be bound up with family. A good example is Pakistan, where Benazir Bhutto is the daughter of a man who was prime minister of Pakistan before her. And the political party is, in fact, a family grouping bound together by personal loyalties and by patronage, by common ideals on the one hand and by material needs and the delivering of material needs on the other hand. That's the kind of thing that Machiavelli's talking about. The Democratic Party in Chicago, where Richard Daley Jr., has managed to put the party back together and seems to be the only one who was capable of putting the party back together after his father's death. I mean, you go through a period of turmoil, and what happens? Richie Daley emerges as the magician who can put the thing back together because of all these family ties and because of all these family loyalties.
I appreciate that because I want to bring our focus to this society and our time. Before doing that, though, let me just take a moment to say this is Dialogue. I'm George Liston C.A., and my guest today is Paul Ray. And Paul is currently a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center. He's also a professor of history at the University of Tulsa. He's a graduate of Yale and Oxford, where he was a Rhodes Scholar, and he's the author of Republics, Ancient and Modern, Classical Republicanism, and the American Revolution, which will be reissued in 3 paperback edition this summer, and it will be published by the University of North Carolina Press. Paul, lots to talk about. First of all, is it appropriate for me to think in this archaeology you've been describing of virtue and its history that we can, in a sense, view the notion of individualism as a basic tenet of political action from the time of Machiavelli? Does he give emphasis to it?
He provides the foundation for it by debunking the alternative, and he provides an understanding of the emergence of the political community that prefigures that of Hobbes. The difference between Machiavelli and the liberal tradition is Machiavelli's not interested in justice. It's a word that plays almost no role within his thinking. And even the other word that you might want to think of in Machiavellian terms is glory. And what distinguishes Hobbes and his successors within the liberal tradition from Machiavelli is Hobbes debunks glory. That, in some sense, is prepared by Montaigne, who debunks the whole notion of glory as a form of cruelty.
Right.
And Hobbes takes that up and systematizes it. So at the center of Hobbesian thinking is justice. And what is justice about? It's about mutual protection. It's about rights. You don't have that sort of language in Machiavelli because his focus is on glory.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a kind of shift. He, in a way, he prepares the way for this.
Right. I don't want to simplify at the risk of destroying the truth of what you're saying, but is Hobbes, in a sense, democratizing Machiavelli?
Yes, he is. No question about
that.
So
that's essentially the point there.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
Here's another way of putting the whole business. Ancient politics is based upon trust. Modern politics is based upon distrust. The reason why friendship can't be central to modern politics is that you simply can't trust other people. You know, in other words,
yeah.
Virtue is a con.
Yeah.
And one can see this sort of thing in the American tradition. I want to read you something that Thomas Jefferson says. At the time of Shays' Rebellion, which is on the eve of the American Constitutional Convention, Jefferson's reasonably exceptional. He's in Paris. In welcoming the rebellion, he says, "I like a little rebellion now and then. It clears the air." But he then goes on and he says that in Europe he sees that under the pretense of governing, they have divided their nations into two classes, wolves and sheep. In his opinion, the same could very easily happen in North America. And one of the reasons it can happen is he was convinced there is such a thing as a natural aristocracy and a natural democracy. The natural aristocracy is not an aristocracy of virtue, it's an aristocracy of talents. And his fear is that the natural aristocracy will exploit its talents in order to exploit the natural democracy of those less talented and less able. And he knows that government will be dominated by those with talents. I mean, he sees that as inevitable. So the problem is, can you prevent the natural aristocrats from becoming wolves and the natural democrats from becoming sheep? And what he says is, cherish therefore the spirit of the people. It's the spirit of the people, their spiritedness, that distinguishes them from sheep. And keep alive, he says, their attention. Focus their attention on public affairs. Do not be too severe upon the errors of common people, but reclaim them by enlightening them. So you need a public school system.
Mm-hmm.
If once they become inattentive to public affairs, he says, you and I, notice that, he says it about himself, you and I and Congress and assemblies, judges and governors shall all become wolves. The only thing that prevents Thomas Jefferson, a putatively virtuous man, from becoming a wolf is that he's watched.
By the mass of citizens.
That's right.
It seems to me that vigilance and suspicion are the hallmarks of our modern political system. I mean, you watch these people because they can do you damage, and there's a sense that they will.
Right.
Left to their own deserts.
Right. That claim that the politics of friendship means corruption has very considerable force.
Mm-hmm.
Because those countries that are governed in this fashion, when one political party or another takes power, usually their motto is enrich ourselves.
Indeed.
So the political party ends up being a conspiracy against the public good, and certainly a conspiracy against those people who are members of another political party.
Yeah.
As a consequence of this, you cannot allow the other political party to take power because they're going to take everything away from you.
Right.
You know, from the perspective of most Americans, whether they be Democrats or Republicans, in truth, it doesn't matter which political party is in power in Washington, because there's a certain kind of abstract universalism that governs the way the society operates.
And to which everyone is held.
Now, let me turn it around.
Yeah, I was going to say, Paul, let me pose the question to you, because you've got my mind working on this. But, and actually, to conclude our conversation, I think it'd be wonderful to get your views on this. Do turn it around and do approach the question from what we've lost, perhaps, by a focus on the impersonal at the expense of the politics of friendship.
It strikes me that societies are organized on principles. If you organize your society on the family principle, and most societies in the past were, it eats away at those more abstract obligations that we all recognized. It's not as if people in ancient Rome and ancient Greece failed to recognize that there are limits to how far you should go in helping your family. They recognized this fact, but they tended to go beyond those limits. And that's true everywhere in the world, as far as I can see. If you turn it around, if you organize your society on a kind of abstract individualism.
As we have.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. In which all or almost all publicly respectable obligations have to do with abstract obligation rather than particular obligation. What you then do is you very gradually erode particular obligations. One of the great crises in our society is the crisis of the family. Arguably, the family throughout the entire society is breaking down. Divorce is highly prevalent. Abandonment of children is a very serious problem. There is a certain sense in which family obligations are no longer respected. And there were always tensions within families that would lead them to split up and divide in certain ways. We seem more and more, as time passes, to act as individuals with no particular obligations, with no sense of involvement in anything larger than ourselves. And consequences, all of our politics gets articulated in terms of the rights of this group, the rights of that group. Nobody talks about duties. So what we're seeing now, I think, is the tip of an iceberg that's going to emerge in the future.
Yes, indeed.
One sign of this is the bastardy rate. I mean, the rate of illegitimacy is increasing remarkably in a fashion that is terrifying for the future because it builds upon itself. And it seems to me that our one-sided focus on rights, which is a natural outgrowth of our whole way of looking at the world, and I see no way of reversing this myself. It seems to me that you, once you pick a kind of outlook, you become more like yourself. It's like becoming drunk. I mean, it's said that when people are drunk, they're themselves. They're just more themselves. Well, in some sense, as time goes on and the political regime evolves, it becomes more itself.
Right.
And certain patterns that are introduced at the beginning seep in. After all, we inherited the family from the period before the Enlightenment, before the French Revolution. We seem to be losing it because the principles of the Enlightenment and some of the principles underlying the American Revolution are at tension with those sorts of loyalties that are involved with the family.
Well, Paul, I can only agree with that, and I deeply appreciate it. I think it's very eloquently stated and very important to all of us. I want to thank you very much for being with us today.
It was a great pleasure.
It's all mine.
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Paul Ray, professor of history at the University of Tulsa. I am George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Assistant producer is Dennis Saunier, and our technical director is John Tyler. Dialogue is presented by APR, American Public Radio, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Radio Smithsonian. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For a cassette copy of this program, or for more information, call the Radio Store at 1-800-747-7444. That's 1-800-747-7444.
From APR, American Public Radio.